and welcome to a special edition of Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future. I'm your host, Maureen Metcalf, founder and CEO of the Innovative Leadership Institute. I'd like to thank the International Leadership Association for their partnership, which brings you the latest academic and practitioner insights for leaders. We recorded many of the 12-session series live in Geneva during their 2021 annual conference, including this one. Enjoy. Welcome. Today's discussion is about post-pandemic approaches to developing future-fit employees and leaders. The increasing rate of work digitization and technology adoption is both creating job displacement and shortening the time required to upskill and reskill employees. As leaders align emerging technologies, worker roles, and job skills with their sustainability intentions, the evolving nature of work imposes a heavy emotional tax on workers who must continuously learn and adapt. We'll discuss how more enlightened leaders are engaging in caring and compassionate workforce and workplace transformation practices while meeting the sustainability goals of their organizations. And I need to say, even in that description, the idea that we're balancing both the need to drive business results and care for our employees is a beautifully inclusive description. So I am delighted that today's guests are Christopher Washington, Ferris Alamy, and this is the presentation that the three of us and
Agnieszka Vosch
did while we were in Geneva. Agnieszka is on a flight home to Poland, so it's just the three of us. Christopher is actually going to be facilitating the conversation, and we appreciate your joining as listeners to engage in this really important work. So, Christopher, would you start by introducing yourself and then Ferris?
Yes, my name is Christopher Washington. I'm the Executive Vice President and Provost at Franklin University. I'm a member of the Forbes Nonprofit Council and a fellow at the Innovative Leadership Institute and board member of Global Ties US. And it's great to be with you here in Geneva, Switzerland.
Thank you, Christopher. Thank you, Maureen. This is Ferris Alamy. I'm the founder of International Strategic Management. We do entrepreneurship and small business development. And of course, I serve on a couple other boards and nonprofits. And I'm also delighted to be part of this discussion. And so good to see you in Geneva. I can't believe it.
Let's jump in.
Well, I'm delighted to discuss this topic, post-pandemic approaches to developing future-fit employees and leaders. And, you know, if you look in the literature today, in the newspapers, we're all hearing about this great interest in the change in the nature of work and the workforce and the workplace. In societies around the world, you know, you hear terms like the Great Resignation, the Great Migration, VUCA, volatility, uncertainty, chaos, and ambiguity impacting the workplace. And we have to create conditions that enable our organizations and our individuals to adapt to these challenges, ideally in ways that make organizations and individuals stronger. And I'm just delighted to talk with you, each of you, about the trends that you're familiar with, the signals of change that you're encountering from your own conversations with leaders in small business, leaders of large organizations, so that we can sort of proliferate these ideas and wisdom to your audience. So I'm very excited. You know, if the audience is interested, we've gathered information from a variety of reports, including the World Economic Forum report in 2021, the McKinsey Company Future of Work Studies, the Institute for the Future, as well as the International Labor Organization. Lots of insight. But more importantly, I'm interested in hearing your signal. So one of the ideas is that the COVID has impacted organizations in a variety of ways. The World Economic Forum, for example, talked about the dual impact of COVID and workforce automation in accelerating changes to worker requirements. And in 2020, over 87% of companies in the U.S., provided opportunities for workers to work remotely, and over 50% in both Poland and the US, accelerating upskilling and reskilling of employees. In terms of technology adoption in the US, over 96% of the share of US companies surveyed suggested that cloud computing was a necessary technology to adopt in their company. More than 90% are using connected devices now differently, and AI and machine learning is growing in popularity. The adoption of these technologies are inevitable. So, my question to you both, let's start with you, Ferris. How is the dual impact of COVID and technology adoption impacting the sustainability strategies of small companies?
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Christopher, for an awesome insights and introduction already. I want to also make sure that I frame the discussion from my perspective with the background that I'm going to provide, meaning I work mainly in underserved, underrepresented minority communities in the economic development space. So therefore, it's with that lens. So, you know, there's obviously much broader lens when you look at the small business. It was a big impact because many of them can't keep up with the demand of what the technology wants. Most of them are running small operations, so therefore they're using maybe pen and paper, not even a computer. Some of them don't even have websites. Some do, but many don't even have websites. So when, even as an example, we mentioned this before with the PPP loan, submit all your stuff electronically. Well, they don't even have it saved electronically to be submitted electronically. So now you're asking them to do lots of things to be done to be able to qualify to apply for a loan or get some funding or financial support. So they went through a bunch of hurdles. And then also their staff might have not been equipped to do social media posting or some of the other ways that they could communicate now, because they were accustomed to maybe printing a flyer and handing it out or dropping it off at someone's desk. Those things were eliminated. And now they had to figure out what to do with this new environment that basically you're completely isolated in your own place and have to find ways to communicate via mediums that did not A, exist in your place, and B, you were not even trained or aware of how to use it. They faced some serious challenges. I mean, some of them obviously were able to overcome it, but many, you know, still struggling with it even today.
Well, how are the more successful ones moving through that change? This is quite transformative. Operating from pen to paper to operating in an ecosystem that is connected through technology. How are they tapping into support necessary to make that happen?
Well, I think you just nailed it. So the ones that were able to move really fast and be able to tap into it were part of what I'm going to call the entrepreneurship ecosystem or small business development ecosystem. And for our purposes, although ecosystem has many different terminology could be used, Babson College has a really wonderful model you could follow, but also Kauffman Foundation has a model. The Global Entrepreneurship Network has a model. So different models that you could look at. But from my perspective, I'm going to just simplify for our conversation with the aspect of business support service organization, like economic development agencies in the city or a community, incubators, accelerators, some business leaders or mentors, chambers of commerce. Those who were plugged into these kinds of players found themselves in a much easier way to transition to at least get equipped to deal with the pandemic. And they were very successful at it, okay? They were able to just move really, now, and when I say quick, meaning, you know, some pain, right? But they were able to move and be able to submit the documents or get back in business or navigate the system to know what is legal or illegal to do in this kind of setting. And that helped them tremendously being part of that ecosystem because A, information was being floated to them correctly. No, he said, she said stuff, right? So information came directly from the right source for the right information for the right time. So yes, you could be open for these hours or you could do these things. No, you cannot be open, but you could do these things in return. Those kinds of information in a pandemic is vital because actually for many of them meant, you know, opening or closing.
Well, it seems like networking, support seeking, and learning are really fundamental competencies to make that change.
Adaptive, you got it. And then being, to what you said earlier, Christopher, is being part of that ecosystem is really key. A lot of times, I think more people are now more aware that there's an ecosystem that exists. Every community has it. Now, it might be more robust than some others, more than one community, more than another, but they all have it. So being part of the ecosystem, that community, could usually save you and help you overcome the humps that you need. And you nailed it. All those things that you mentioned are exactly what they had to do to get there.
Now, Maureen, you're working with large companies and leaders of large companies as an executive coach, as an interviewer who's helping to sort of tease out trends. What do you see the ways in which leaders are successfully responding to these changes, this pandemic, as well as technology adoption?
So it's been interesting to watch. During the initial part of the pandemic, I was working with a lot of technology leaders. And so they were busy as can be just getting people, you know, with 5 minutes notice. People had to get home. They had to be working. So those who had laptops could take their laptops home, and they were accustomed to that. But there were a whole percentage of the workforce for those who got to work from home. Now, there were still a lot of people who had to show up if they're in the healthcare space or hospitality space, and many people lost their jobs. So I'm talking about the people who are now able to work remotely. Because folks thought this was going to be a short-term thing, they were taking their desktops home because if you remember, at the point where the pandemic hit, companies were ordering a massive amount of laptops, and the ability to produce those wasn't available.
That's right.
So they're coming and taking their desktops home, and then a few days later, they'd come in and take their printer home, and then they'd schedule times when no one was in the office that they would use some of the shared devices. So while we thought it was a short-term transition, I think a lot of people put their heads down and tried to fix a problem. What then started to happen was, over time, as we saw 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year and a half, for many people now they're grappling with how do we come back, not come back. So for folks who were good at jumping in and solving a problem, not all of them transitioned to the mindset of navigating unplanned, unexpected change. So folks who were good at doing the planning and defining the change, when it was inflicted on them by a global pandemic, some did not thrive. What's been interesting to me is what are the characteristics that leaders need to develop so that they can succeed in this more VUCA, volatile, ambiguous, complex environment, because those characteristics will be different. And it's been fascinating to watch some people who are very clear, we're not going back. Frankly, for a lot of organizations, we'd already started these changes. We had started to work more remotely. For hospitals, they had started remote care. The challenge was helping physicians who are most comfortable. They were trained to touch bodies, right? And it's probably more effective to be able to touch a body. And yet, if we look at someone like a cancer patient where they're coming for a follow-up, do they need to get on a plane and a train and a bus to go do a 10-minute follow-up? Or can they work remotely, which makes the follow-up visits more accessible? So even physicians I've seen be really excited about the accessibility of their services for these, in many cases, very delicate, sick patients. I've heard lots of statistics, but we are adapting years of what would have been traditional change management into weeks. And that evolution of leadership mindset really needs to match the evolution of employee expectations.
Well, I want to get into that conversation about the leadership qualities, competencies that are necessary given these conditions you talked about. But before we do so, I want to layer on an additional level of complexity. So, for example, there's been a tremendous amount of disruption in the division of labor due to technology. Man and machine, mankind and machine.
People.
People and machine. According to the World Economic Forum, 43% of businesses surveyed indicate that they are set to reduce their workforce due to technology integration. 41% plan to expand their use of contractors for task-specialized work. So, you know, this sort of gig economy worker. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And 34% plan to expand their workforce due to technology integration. There's a whole mix of things happening. In fact, some industries are receiving more employees from other industries, 37% moving into their industry, while at the same time, maybe 30% or more moving out of their industry. There's just a lot of mobility as it relates to this disruption in terms of worker and machine interaction. In addition, there's an emergence of these new roles in workplace, AI, machine learning specialists, data analysts, big data specialists, etc. At the same time, we're seeing a redundancy of jobs, resulting in the sort of reduction of workforce. So you're seeing less data entry clerks and accountants and administrative executive assistants and client information customer service reps that's being automated. It's estimated that the time spent on current tasks at work by humans and machines will be equal. That's a tremendous change. What are you all seeing as challenges related to these issues and the demands of employers and leaders in response to this change?
One of the things that I am most concerned about, and it's more of a social issue, the significant expenditure to retrain people and the stratification of who gets training. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a six-figure employee, the company has likely invested a great deal in me, and I will likely get training required. If I'm an hourly worker at minimum wage, or at even $25 an hour, the company is likely less invested in me because I'm more of an interchangeable part. And I'm also living in an economic strata where I am less likely to have the financial cushion to take 3 months off work to go get a new certification to be fluid in job change. Mm-hmm. And the tightening of labor force in that way is actually interesting because it is disavowing companies of the idea that I'm just going to toss away this one and swap in another part like I would an old printer when it stops working. I just get a new one because they're $100. Employees now, we're not able to swap those that we didn't train for those that somebody else did train. So the accessibility, and I want to use our partnership, Christopher, as an example. So the Innovative Leadership Institute is partnering with Franklin University, with Expedient, a cloud computing company, and with the city of Dublin, Ohio, to train technology people, some leaders, some emerging leaders, into leadership roles. And this gets back to the ecosystem. So our community says to attract and retain companies, we need good leaders. And people don't want to come to a region if there's only one company in the region they can work for and then they have to relocate. So it's really building the ecosystem that will attract companies and attract employees. So the program has 50 participants per session and 50 making it economically accessible. So organizations can pay $1,200 or $2,000 where they may not be able to pay $5,000 to educate these leaders. So the city benefits, Expedient gets to offer their clients a great service because when people are moving to the cloud, it shifts their entire workforce. So Expedient's offering a value for a reasonable investment. Franklin is certifying, so participants get guaranteed university caliber education, as opposed to, I don't know what I'm getting because some company says we're getting good stuff. But in fact, the university validation to me is very important in the partnership, and the way we're delivering the training is different. And by that, I mean, a lot of people can go online and do LinkedIn learning and podcasts, and I support all of that. What this does is gives the addition of building community and having the important conversations to process what I've learned. So they will do the podcast, they'll do the quote homework or assignments that are linked to university level certification. And so that's the flipped classroom. I do the learning outside. And then when I come into a class for 2.5 hours, we have conversations about how does this apply. We do role plays. We do the things that actually adults require to take something from stuff I read in a paper or learned in a podcast to something I take into myself and actually do.
I'm excited that we are experiential learning partners, that institutions are collaborating to identify needs of a community and to respond to it. And one other aspect of that need is the employers can't wait for learners to acquire the knowledge in 4 years in a degree program or 6 years in a master's degree program. We're finding ways to collaborate to provide shorter duration programs that lead to the knowledge and skill necessary to be successful today. And that's not uncommon. On top of the changes in this division of labor, the window of opportunity to reskill and upskill workers has become shorter in this shifting labor market. On average, companies in the U.S. estimate that 40% of their workers will require retraining in 6 months or less. Mm-hmm. So this is a really good collaborative way to address that need for the reskilling. What's going on in
this small business world
as it relates to this reskilling, upskilling challenge?
Well, I mean, I want to address first thing, I wanted to tap into Maureen's point, call it the digital gap, has really grown tremendously. So for those who have or those who don't, the gap is much bigger. I mean, one of the things I use as an example is even going to McDonald's is becoming a gap because you can't even go into it. And if you don't have a car and you don't have a phone, you can't even go through the drive-thru. These are real things that happen that we need to, at one point, come back and revisit as a humanity, as a society, because we don't want to have that kind of gap for our human being in our communities. There are some big trends. One of the biggest trends that I'm seeing, to Maureen's point, is faster training. So usually 2 to 3 months. And I agree. I think those LinkedIn and online learnings are awesome. They do lack what I'm going to call the structural outcomes that it's looking for as a group. So therefore, sure, I could learn how to do a social media post really quickly, but I don't have the structure of understanding what's the strategy behind it, why you're doing it, and all those things that comes with a structural education. And we do training, as you know, so therefore it's really important to have a structural outcomes that someone studied and understand why we're doing this piece for do what specific outcome and linking them together. And in universities like yours is obviously what you do every day. So those kinds of things are really important. One of the things that we're also seeing that people gaining the skill set that they're learning, to Maureen's point, and then they're jetting to the next job.
Because yeah, a lot of mobility.
A lot of mobility, because in the past, I quit because I wanted to live somewhere. So we all know people used to quit for lifestyle. So I want to live in the city, so I'm going to quit. Well, now I could quit because I don't believe in the purpose of what you're doing. I'm going to quit because I don't like the work that I'm doing. I could quit. And yes, of course, I want to live somewhere else because now I could work anywhere. So the chances of me wanting to reasoning to quit is much higher than what used to be before. And the gain on it is much higher. So if I could learn from you, working with you for 3 months and you scale, thank you so much. I'm going to work with Maureen now because now she's going to pay me a little bit more, or has the jobs that I want, or she has a different purpose that I want to be doing, or she's in the city that maybe I want to move to, although she doesn't want me to go to the office, but I'm going to move there anyway. So all these kinds of things are now becoming more real, more happening right now. And I agree that in the small business world, they can't even wait 6 months. They're looking for like a day or two, because a day or two means cash flow. If I don't get you to really remove fast, then now I have no cash. If I'm not selling today, I have no cash for to bring the food. If it's a restaurant for the next day or for the next week, and if it's a manufacturing, you know, it's already delayed with the 60, 90 days payment. So now if I don't have this going on, or this product being produced, now I'm a little behind.
Maureen and Ferris, are either of you concerned about the way employees are being educated and trained today? And by that, I mean, there was a recent study that suggests that 90% of employees are doing their own development, pursuing their own path of development, whether it's through some mechanism online, like online training has exploded fivefold in the last year and a half, mm-hmm. or some other means, self-development, on-the-job training, mm-hmm. non-structured. Are either of you concerned about that? What are you seeing in terms of methods of education of employees today, given all this rapid change in technology and resulting from the pandemic?
Democratization of new skills, I think, is brilliant, right? So if you go to a reputable organization, something like LinkedIn, they have a high quality filter. My concern with stuff on the internet, just like we see conspiracy theories and all kinds of other stuff
yes.
pervading, just because it's on the internet clearly does not make it good or right. And same thing with podcasts. We're doing one, so clearly we value them. We value high quality ones. So going to an NPR platform or someone like that, that has done some validation of the substance of the content.
That content curation really becomes important in a mm-hmm. sea of information and available resources, I'm assuming.
Yeah, because you can waste your time and learn all kinds of stuff that's inaccurate, or spend your time learning things that just isn't as valuable. And I think that's where a balance of both self-curating, because I need to own my own success. My organization, in many cases, in small business may not have the resources. In large business is, in some cases, not all, more concerned with bottom line than my career development.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those that are concerned with employee development are the better places to work now and will attract the highest caliber employees over time. And yet, again, not every business has the resources to do that. So the balance of self-curating and going to university-based certifications. So university now doesn't need to be the 4-year degree or the 2-year master's degree. It can also be a point certification in
micro-credentials or certification, sure.
So I think employees and employers have a lot of different options. We did a podcast recently with someone from MIT talking about some of the big universities offer these free courses. And again, there is a difference between I listen to something on a podcast and I absorb it and take it in and do my work differently.
Mm-hmm.
One qualifies me to be good at a cocktail party and trivia. The other qualifies me to be a better employee.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we as people who are doing the learning and leaders encouraging our employees to do the learning, there's absorbing the content and then there's the discussion and processing and applying it to who we are as individuals and how we do the work. And until we do that latter part, I don't think we can call it education. I think we call it absorbing content.
Mm-hmm. Let's transition a little bit because we've been talking a lot about this notion of technical skill adoption. But McKinsey and Company point out that there are a range of skills needed for the workforce we need today, the leaders we need today. Mm-hmm. That includes things like higher cognitive skills mm-hmm. and social and emotional skills. In addition to technical, self-management, active learning, there are a whole host of these things. What are you all seeing as the workforce we need and the leaders we need today?
You may recall, Christopher, I was lucky enough to have a call with all the entrepreneurs and leaders of their communities. And what we learned is from those 4,000 to 5,000 calls that we had, and one of the things that we identified, we called it today resilient entrepreneur mindset. But it's really a couple of things. One of them is the mindset of the individuals, so how they look at things as a problem or an opportunity. Are they willing to step up to take it or not? Are they willing to take a risk on it or not? Are they willing to show some compassion, because now we're in a crisis mode, so you can't just be a dictator style leader? Are you able to your point earlier, navigate through the swim of information? Because I could watch a YouTube of how to do something for 2 hours, and the only thing I learned is one person's story, which is nice, but it doesn't tell me how am I going to do what I need to do. And now they want me to pay for, you know, $50, $100, $500, whatever the number is, to learn what I signed up to watch anyway or learn. So all those things are becoming much more relevant, important skills today.
I think this is the opportunity to talk about the distinction between horizontal development. I learn a new skill.
Yeah.
So I learn social media posting or how to read a balance sheet and a P&L.
Sure.
And then there's the vertical development that is fundamentally shifting my meaning making and my mindset. And I think both are required. So with new technology, I need new skills, clearly. I can't just do the old stuff that I've always done. And if I'm not changing my mindset, which requires a very different kind of development than going to a LinkedIn learning or a day-long workshop on Excel formulas, if we are not developing the sophistication of thinking and being in our leaders, they're not able to develop the agility and the resilient skills in themselves and in their organizations. So Christopher talks a lot about anti-fragile. If I don't have that advanced mindset, I can't look across the range of information that I'm taking in, make different meaning of it than I used to, because the world's now changed, and respond appropriately. All of that in the meaning-making activity, understanding the ecosystem, understanding global impact of decisions I make, and at the same time, keeping my brain healthy, keeping my physiology healthy. The amount of stress I think all of us are experiencing is exponentially higher than it was 2 years ago, and it's going to get higher.
This notion of resilience and stress tolerance is really critical as an additional skill set that's required when things are chaotic, ambiguous, volatile, and uncertain. So I'm glad you brought that up. You mentioned anti-fragility, and I really do like the notion of anti-fragility thinking as it relates to organizations. You know, you can think about things that are fragile, mm-hmm. that break individuals and organizations that perhaps break under stress and duress, and individuals and organizations that are strong and durable under stress and duress. And you can think about them in terms of their anti-fragility. It's a wonderful topic. They actually get stronger under stress and duress. And I think organizations today during the pandemic, some were expected to have double-digit growth. Mm-hmm. And so that can break some systems, or you could certainly, individuals, leaders, staff, and organizations can adapt to those conditions to achieve those goals. Are there qualities that you see in leaders that enable them to function more effectively under stress?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll go back to that notion of seeing opportunities versus problems, right? So the entrepreneurship mindset is becoming clearly more relevant. The concept of wanting to step up and take a risk on something is now much more relevant, because I'm learning something new, I'm doing something new. It might not work, it might work, but I'm stepping into it and seeing how it works. So that whole notion of no one else is doing it, I'm doing it now, is really an important skill. The compassion skill is important. I will also add a few more things. One of them is ability to relate to people and being vulnerable, because we are now all vulnerable, right? So before, you could hide behind the executive office and do whatever. Well, today you're turning your camera on and your dog is running in the backyard, right? And now you're being a little bit more vulnerable than you were before, because now I'm seeing your actual life settings, whether you're a leader or an employee or anything else in between, right? You're now being open about the vulnerability versus trying to hide it becomes really key skill, especially for the leaders. You want to show the vulnerability, but you also want to give them the comfort that you're going to make it okay. And if you don't do that, then they're already in the middle of chaos, and then you add more chaos from you as a leader given to them, then it's going to add more chaotic lifestyle for them that they might not be able to take it, because they already now, they used to be able to leave work for a minute at least and go home. Well, now they're living at work. So their kids are running, their wife or husband or significant other, some of them are taking from their grandparents as well, or parents. Some of them are living with their friends. So all kinds of things now is adding more stress to their life. So you need the leader to show that they're understanding by showing their own vulnerability, but then showing that we're going to work through it together through these kinds of means.
You both talked about this at different points during the conference here in Geneva, about the notion of purpose-driven leaders mm-hmm. and how they communicate that to their employees as a way to retain them, to humanize the workplace. Could you talk a moment about that? This idea of the leader, their vulnerability, their sense of purpose, and how they get that message across to their people.
So I want to give an example of a client with whom I'm working. So they have the organizational purpose. They also have the purpose of stability of the organization. The founder's purpose is to address something that Ferris has talked about. They work with people who are unbanked and underbanked and give them access to technology. Imagine having no access to the internet or phone. You can't apply for a job. There are so many things you can't do. Mm-hmm. So the founder's commitment is there are 80-some million people just in the U.S. who are un- or underbanked, who now have access to a better life because they have digital access. So that's one. The COO came as an immigrant to the U.S. out of a war-torn environment. He ran a very successful company. When the war broke out, he lost everything. And his commitment is to create a stable company where those hundreds of employees have a stable income. Their families have stability. They can count on the fact that the company is operated responsibly so that they can know the next paycheck's coming. They can commit to their children's college education. They can buy homes. They can reach that dream of having the life that he was able to have mm-hmm. lost and has now built not only for his family, but for hundreds of families. And I think that's also an interesting balance of we're committed to our clients, but we're also committed to the very precious people who are giving us their time and their effort when they show up to work every day.
That sounds like a very human-centered solution to the challenges, the crisis we face, and our need to adapt mm-hmm. to changing circumstances like technology in our world. Very human-centered approach to it. Maureen, that's a fascinating story about leadership in action. And I'm curious to know the competencies that's required to get the culture to understand a leader's disposition. Mm-hmm. Ferris, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, so one of the things I think is important is I call it the art of storytelling. So you can't just go out and dump information out to say all these things or all those things. I think it's just the story that you come out and articulate and the framing that you use to articulate the story becomes really important, especially for the employees, because it might be their first time hearing it. And they also might be scared when they hear it. And the reason I say that, because to the leader, it might be a natural thing to move from one thing to another and transition. But for an employee or for someone who's just joining the organization or being part of the organization, they're looking at stability. They already have lots of things going on in their life that is not stable. So they're looking at how you articulate the story and how you frame it becomes really important versus just information to earlier discussion that you could just hear somewhere else. But now you're hearing about your company that could make you nervous.
So yeah, in that storytelling, you're really helping to shape culture. You're sharing purpose. You're describing principles that make that community. Maureen, what's your thought about this?
One of the things I think is really important, especially as we moved into the pandemic time, is this ability to be authentic and reflective. Mm-hmm. So in the past, the role of many leaders was plan the work, drive the work, measure the work, and make sure employees had the tools they needed. But their emotional relationships really often happened with peers and outside of work. What seemed to happen during the pandemic is, Ferris, to your point, people are worried, right? They don't know what's going to happen next. And frankly, neither do we as leaders. And part of our responsibility is to help connect emotionally with our employees. We know through the Gallup research, having a best friend at work causes us to be much more engaged and confident, comfortable. If I make a mistake, I know I can go talk to somebody. If I'm wanting to think through a question, I can go talk to somebody. Now the role of leader as also having an emotional bond really seem to come online. And it's been interesting as people start to move back to the workplace where the most effective leaders took time to say, not only how are you doing with your work, but how are you doing? How is your family doing? How are your kids? How are you navigating the multiple challenges of worrying about a family member who was diagnosed with COVID and now they're sequestered in a different part of the house? All of these challenges, that emotional connection really differentiated effective versus ineffective. So leaders understanding authenticity. And I say that because I think it's an important distinction that everything that comes into my head should not come out of my mouth. No. Right. If I'm authentically really angry with you right now, I maybe sit on that and think about how much of this is me and how much of it is you, and when can I appropriately have that conversation? So in no way am I saying share everything,
yep.
Especially if you're a jerk. Keep your mouth shut. Right? Authentically care and keep the rest to yourself. So there is certainly a time for anger and frustration, but there is also a time to balance and prioritize care over everything else that's going in my head. And again, it's the balance of compassion and wisdom, having the sense to know what to say and what not to say. And we're going to make mistakes. But that authenticity is that part. And then the reflection, really processing deeply and meaning making. So somebody said something to me in a conversation. What meaning do I attribute to those words? How do I interpret what's going on in the ecosystem and in the context of the ecosystem? Because Christopher and I can have a conversation. He can say the same thing pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, and here at the conference. And he may mean something very different by those same words. So we as leaders need to continue to update our own thinking algorithm and really up our ability to make sense of what's happening in the context of the individual who's sitting in front of us, who may be struggling mightily with family members, mm-hmm. all of the responsibilities they have. They're working incredibly late because they have to take care of their kids' school during the day, and then they're doing their jobs at midnight, mm-hmm. and they know they've got to get up at 6 a.m. to deal with other family stuff. So we think our ability as leaders to relate and let people know that they're safe and supported, and they still have to get their jobs done. So right. It's not just we like you, but you have to get the work done too. How do we balance that?
I'm going to build on that theme. So I've heard from Faris this idea of the importance of storytelling. I heard from you the sense of meaning making and empathy, right? And to be able to translate that into storytelling, there's sort of a cycle of reflection mm-hmm. and action that's related to meaning making and storytelling, but also this notion of care for your people. I want to build on that theme because you talked about the importance of connection and the abilities of leaders to connect people to other people. We talked about the sense of belonging that is sort of the fabric of organizations today. Mm-hmm. You're a member, you belong, you connect. In today's world, we put people apart. We sent people home for, you know, a year and a half in some cases, and they felt isolated. That related to higher levels of anxiety and depression. In fact, the U.S. Center for Disease Control said that in April of 2021, during the pandemic, the percentage of adults with symptoms of anxiety or depressive disorder increased from 36% to 41%. And the percentage of those reporting unmet mental health care needs increased from 9.2% to 11.2%. What are we doing in our workplaces? What are you seeing from leaders to help them, in addition to building community, adapt to be mentally well?
One of the things I'm doing personally is working with a brain coach to help me understand how my brain works and how brains work, not just mine, and understanding the chemicals, the healthy chemicals that our brains produce that keeps our bodies healthy, and how do we evoke those? So things like working out with a friend, which we can do. We actually, in my home, got an app for our phone, and we would work out together in the morning and evening. And these things are inexpensive.
I found that walking my dog was sort of meditative moments for mm-hmm. me during this period.
And I realize it's also a luxury that we had the time, but the sure. morning workout is an 8.5-minute workout, by the way. So many of us can make that much time to do the things that not only keep our bodies healthy, but create the positive mental hormones. One of the things we talked about in the session yesterday is the value of meditation and just grounding and disavowing us of the idea that meditation means I go for an hour and sit on a special cushion. Because for me, that means I fall asleep, by the way. So, but when we come into a Zoom meeting, taking 1 minute and grounding on the intention we're here, spending 1 minute before the meeting, thinking about each of the people with whom I'm going to be meeting and the reasons I appreciate them. So creating this mindset of positivity, even if I'm not wired to be a happy person, people like me who became consultants are wired to find problems, not happy. So how do we build in the discipline to say, I'm meeting with Christopher and he's brilliant in this way. I'm meeting with Ferris and he's brilliant in that way. Come in, take a minute, ground on why we're here. Entirely can change the tone of the meeting. So I think there are things that promote our mental well-being that we can do even when we're on Zoom meetings. I often tell people I'm not going to have my camera on. I'm going to put a headset on. I'm going to walk. I encourage them to do the same if we don't have to be taking notes. And that being outside keeps me from multitasking, checking email, because the things are going, and most of us do that, and allows me to physically be moving, which engages my brain differently.
Well, let me throw a special challenge out to both of you. You're a single mom, you're an entrepreneur, you have three kids, you have to be on a Zoom call. What might you recommend to that person to facilitate their mental health?
So I wanted to thank you for that, Maureen. That's a lot to unfold there, actually. So one of the things that I really quickly discovered in March of last year, and not only personally, but also talking to, remember, I'm working with small business owners, medium business owners, leaders for specific communities like underserved or underprivileged or underrepresented. They already were working 12-hour days, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were lucky enough to work half days before, right? 12 hours every day. Mm-hmm. And with the pandemic, they just are now 14, 16, 18 hours, maybe 20. In addition to work for school, teaching the kids, creating a Zoom, cooking, cleaning, all those things now all at the same time. So one of the things I discovered that none of us were doing for probably at least 2 to 4 weeks initially, and we started saying, please do this, okay, which is I'm going to call it white space or clear space. And Maureen described it beautifully. You described it beautifully with the walk with the dog, right? And it's really about we had time before to process information. So even that drive from one meeting to another, even that flight allowed me to process some information. So therefore, I could then return, come up with better solutions, better ways to say something and things of that nature. Well, with the pandemic, for me, for an example, it was meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting. Oh, wow, I forgot to eat lunch. Oh, wow, I forgot to go to the bathroom. Oh, wow, I haven't even said hello to my kids that came back, you know, that finished school for the day. Although they didn't go anywhere, they were here, but I didn't even say hello to them yet. All those things started taking, I call it, pressure on the entrepreneurs, leaders in the community. And I started saying, please take 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and I'm going to call it clarity time. And every person is going to be different. In your case, walking the dog. In your case, just taking a call on a walk, right? In my case, maybe just taking a single walk or taking the family on a walk. Every person had to find what would work for them. Meditation, whatever that is, just create. We all have the same time, 12, 24 hours a day, but create this sphere that allows you to process this information and be able to digest it. So that's what I will say. Take the time to figure out what you would need to do and do that.
To build on that, then, the single mom with three kids, bless you, I can't even imagine the stresses that that creates. One of the things I saw in our little neighborhood is people cooperating with neighbors very differently.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
This is the stress makes you stronger. People had to find ways to support themselves and one another. And it really became kind of a community health challenge that I happened to be fortunate to live in a very supportive neighborhood. And people were taking on the tasks they could. So we would go to Costco because we weren't immune compromised. Somebody else would take care of pets or cooking for people. What I saw at the best of people was a mom can take care of her kids and somebody else's kid and program these in. One of the things it seems like single moms and dads got really good at is I have to manage my time even better than I did before. So let's calendar from 8 to 8:15 in the morning, you have the kids. From 8:15 to 8:30, I have all the kids. And then we start our business day at 8:30 or whatever time it is. finding ways to extend our community of support into our neighborhoods, because our parents who took those roles often, our grandparents, they were all excluded in many cases because of the virus and concern about kids getting people sick because they, you know, eat dirt and stuff. So grandparents were excluded. So we found different ways of building support systems.
Well, you know, there's real power in this concept of social infrastructure and finding social infrastructure. An example of that for me is carpooling. You know, kids can carpool to school so I don't have to drive every day back and forth. Maybe I'm driving one day a week back and forth, and another parent's helping share that workload. Tap into the social infrastructure is what you're suggesting.
Which we did in our past with barn raising and things.
Yes.
Some of these are not new concepts, but as we became a more affluent nation in the U.S., we lost that community sense, and we may be rebuilding it.
As a future fit skill. Yeah.
Yeah, so the co-ops, I'm going to call it, the rise of co-ops. So co-op with family, you know, going to the store together, co-oping with the kids, co-op teaching, co-op, all of those things is, I'm going to call it, the rise of co-op is something that we definitely saw. So we saw many neighbors teaching their kids together. So therefore, one day a week at least, or 2 days a week, or 4 days a week, if there are four families cooperating together, that the kids will go to that one house and log in or do a teaching there. So therefore, those other families have a break, and then it will just rotate. So it seemed like 3 to 5 families will do that together, and then every 3 to 5 more families will do that. And then for sure, the grocery, we saw a big rise of that. So I think the co-op mentality, being part of a community, I go back to that ecosystem building, not only in business, but also in your personal life. And yes, the ecosystem had to change because you couldn't do family ecosystem, you had to do community ecosystem, because you no longer could count on cousins or aunts or uncles, because they might have been excluded with this part, and now you have to find new friends, new neighbors to do some of these things with.
You know, as we come to closure, I want you both to think about and respond to this question: what are leaders doing to become more future fit? Some of the better practices. What are leaders doing to ensure that their employees are more future fit? This is what I want you to think on. And I'm going to suggest that educational institutions like mine, Franklin University, we're doing different things to make sure that employees are future fit. We are providing more micro-credentials. We're providing more experiential learning opportunities through internships and apprenticeships and clinical experiences so that their learning maps to the work requirements of the future opportunities that are available to them. We're introducing new majors in hot areas like data analytics and cybersecurity, where there is a lot of employment opportunities but fewer people in those roles. Those are some things we're doing. What are you seeing out there in terms of leaders' better practices to become more future fit and for their employees to be more future fit?
We're partnering with Franklin University to develop a certification program.
We like that.
We're also, the podcast series is morphing over time, because my commitment is, as we leave our traditional education, we as leaders need to continue to grow and develop. And I want to create an opportunity for leaders who want to continue to do that in a way that's democratized. Because back to Ferris's point, we look in some of the underdeveloped countries, they can't even afford a book. So a free podcast, if they understand English, is an option. Additionally, offering curated, structured programs that are as absolutely efficient as possible for companies who are investing in building. You've got a VP of something, you want them to be an SVP. How do we assess them using data-driven assessments? So highly validated assessment tools. And again, I realize that there were people who were using tools in ways that they weren't intended. And the results tell you something, but it may not at all drive you to the thing you're trying to develop. So using a personality assessment to align with a job is just, in my view, suboptimal. So using data-driven tools to really hone in on what people need to develop, and then laser focus on using the asynchronous and synchronous tools, partially to make it time efficient, and the other is economically efficient. Companies don't know where their revenue's coming from, and so doing as much as employees can do online asynchronous allows them the flexibility and allows the company the best results for the investment. And when they do a company cohort-based program, they're not only developing their leaders, they're also changing their culture and their systems concurrently. So it is an internal ecosystem reinforcement, so they get a significantly higher return on investment than they would sending off to a different program. And we offer both because there's value in both. But I think there's an especially significant impact of company-based programs, shared language, shared models, shared experience in developing themselves and reinforcing others in development.
And shared problems to work on together through the development experience.
And yeah, so they're solving the company's problems.
That's right.
Rather than doing a case study for someone else. Yeah. And I think there's real value in solving our problems.
Yeah, that's interesting because in the, you know, somewhat similar and somewhat different yet is in the small business world, because I see that they want to come from different groups because they want to see what others are facing versus the bigger company obviously having the capacity to do one cohort. The smaller organization I'm working with, they're wanting to just send one person to go through the program, but they're like the concept that I have. Someone else is calling from St. Louis, another person calling from D.C., another person is calling from Myanmar. And that mix, it seems to be something that they're interested in. But in the same time, I want to echo Maureen's point, we're also seeing a rise of, you know, I'm going to call it individualized, customized training or education for one specific person. So they know they don't want to be part of the group. They want to just have one-on-one with who they feel they will get the maximum from. So there seems to be a rise of that as well. I will say I also have seen a lot of introduction with this, you know, as you know, 3-2-2 or 2-2-3, whatever formats that they're using, 2 days at work, 2 days at home, 3 days off, or 3 days at work in the office, 2 days at home, 2 days off. I've seen also 4-9-4. Some of the manufacturers are, you know, you can't work from home because you got to build a widget and you have to use a machine in the manufacturer. So you have to show up. But they are coming up with, like, you know, maybe 4-9-4, meaning 4 days, 9 hours, and then you don't have to come the fourth last day, or you come for half a day. They're being more creative about those kinds of things. So that flexibility. I'm also seeing a rise of what I'm going to call health days or mental days. I'm seeing a lot of organizations allowing the employees to be able to say, I'm going to just take a day off, where those things did not really exist before, you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the other things we're focusing on significantly is we talked about vertical development in addition to horizontal development. We're starting to assess successors or next level leaders on both vertical and job fit. So where do I fit now? Where am I vertically and what's my potential? And really using that as a screen to identify best fit. And in the past, we didn't look as much at vertical development. And I think that is a significant opportunity for us to think about those people who have a more sophisticated meaning making, because building that is multi-year, not multi-day or multi-week. So if we can find those individuals who are already at a later stage of development and nurture them, I think our organizations get a significantly better return on investment.
You know, that's fantastic. I think we've been talking the last 50 minutes or so about future fitness of workforce. I'm hopeful that your audience derives some nuggets from it. Perhaps many of them feel reinforced in their current practice. And our intention is, how do we make organizations healthier during these very difficult times? Thank you so much for giving me the chance to interview you both on this subject.
Christopher, thank you. You've been so kind, and you have lots of nuggets as well. So thank you. And thank you, Maureen, for having us, of course.
Thank you, Ferris. And thank you, Christopher, for your partnership and facilitation and wisdom on the topic. A quick postscript. Our partnership with the International Leadership Association made today's interview possible. We hope you found our special guest's insights valuable. I'm Maureen Metcalf. Thanks so much for joining us and for doing your part to be a better leader.